First, good morning. May it please the court. First, I want to apologize for not being here promptly at 9 o'clock. It was a traffic accident, and then I drove up to what I thought was the Court of Appeals, and there was a hole in the ground there. So, yeah, I just run about a total of 10 blocks trying to find this place. And I can tell you now that other people in other courthouses don't even know what courts are in their building. But anyway, I'm here now, and I apologize. Okay, well, let me begin and by saying this. This is an appeal of a trial to the court that lasted one day. And I think that's important because a lot of decisions were made by the trial court judge in a short amount of time. I think also what's critical to this case is this point. The main issue in this case is personal liability under the terms of a promissory note. And that issue, I think, is really dependent upon the construction of contracts, determination whether they are ambiguous or not ambiguous, and an application of the Uniform Commercial Code to the contracts and how you interpret the promissory note. And I think that's critical because this court is then in an ideal situation to go ahead and correct what we think was a significant error by the trial court. And I can tell you why I believe that, and you will agree with me. I'm going to go. This case, there's that issue on it, and then there's also another issue with respect to liability of an LLC that was involved, and that in part depends upon testimony that was given with respect to fraud and then detrimental reliance on fraud. But I think that there's another legal basis to get around that, and the court can also rule on that issue as well. I'm going to give you some background on this case, not because I think necessarily the facts are all that important, the issue you need to decide, at least the principal issue about personal liability under this note, but I think it not only helps you with the legal argument, but it also helps you then understand the equities of the situation. What this whole situation evolves out of this, there's this man by the name of Kent Murray. He has no business background to speak of. He has never purchased a business before. He is a computer programmer. He works in a bicycle shop, and he's driving down a street in old Colorado City and sees this sign up for sale of real estate. And on this real estate, there's this place that develops these ornamental concrete pieces. And he looks at it, sees the for sale sign on it, and he goes in. And to make a long story short, and this is kind of a critical issue that may come up with respect to the documents. Make a long story short, there are two different owners of this location. One owned the real property. His name was Wayne Hutchinson. And the other one owned the real property, and his name was Steve Hutchinson. And we're talking about Steve Hutchinson actually owned the business, which would include just the assets that were there on the business and the name of the business and Blue Sky, if anything, but not any aspect of the real property. And that becomes significant. So Murray, at that point, decides he wants to buy this place, or he's interested in buying it, and has a number of communications with Steve Hutchinson regarding the business and Wayne Hutchinson regarding purchasing the real property. And I'll tell you a little bit about the discussions that were had and the representations were made.
Mr. Voss, just let me interrupt you briefly. Sure. To remind you, you only have 15 minutes, I just want to be certain you're aware of that.
I will whistle through this, the rest of it. Bottom line is, the brief contains a number of representations that were made by Mr. Hutchinson in terms of business. I think that you're going to find that what happened in this situation is Mr. Hutchinson found somebody who was a novice at purchasing business and found the right guy to purchase this business because what it was represented to be, it wasn't. Among the things that were represented, it was represented to be was that it produced $60,000 a year in gross income for the last 3 years of operation. And then Mr. Murray asked to see the tax returns, and Mr. Hutchinson represented to him, well, the tax returns won't show that.
Those are disputed issues of fact, aren't they? Didn't the trial court resolve that against you?
He did, but on the detrimental reliance issue, Your Honor, I want to talk about that, and that's what I'm going to get to. All right, with respect to the other aspects of it, so Murray at that point, he pulls off the form off the internet site to go ahead and do a letter of intent. He does his letter of intent as an individual and puts that letter of intent together, and it says right on the letter of intent, it's a non-binding document, non-binding agreement. Puts his letter of intent in to buy the assets of the business, and I think the real property was included on that too. Hutchinson goes ahead and signs that letter of intent, and then Murray at that point does the right thing and goes to a lawyer. Lawyer says, you don't want to, and this is Phil DeCaro, I don't know if you know that name or not, he's been in the Springs for a number of years. Lawyer says, you don't want to own the real, you don't want to own the assets of the business in your own name because you don't know what they're worth and you don't want to have personal liability for that. So what he does is he sets up a limited liability company for Mr. Murray at that point in time. And it's called Colorado Concrete Creations, whatever the other name of the plaintiff is in this case. But he sets that up specifically for that purpose because he doesn't want Mr. Murray to have liability on this. That document is dated February 3. It's provided to Mr. Hutchison, who has it for 3 days before he decides to read and sign it. And during those 3 days, he has, by his own testimony, direct input into the terms of that contract. He's negotiating provisions on it, and they put this contract together. And so Hutchison signs it, and then Hutchison has it in his possession for about a month before they're going to close on this transaction. Significant things about that contract, the purchase contract. Again, remember, Mr. DeCaro had said he wanted to make it so Mr. Murray had no personal liability on this thing. So he sets it up as an LLC. If you take a look at the contract itself, it clearly denotes that the buyer of these assets is an LLC and only an LLC. It says that the only security for the assets is a security interest in the assets themselves. It references that there's going to be a promissory note that's created with respect to the situation.
Sorry to interrupt. What about paragraph 14?
And that's why I raised the issue before.
I mean, buyer seems to refer to someone buying real property.
Two things on that, though. The contract itself is only for the sale of the assets. And the only parties that...
Well, but this is a contract that refers to a buyer as Mr. Murray.
No.
And the introductory provision.
Well, no, with all due respect, it does not. It refers to Mr. Buyer, first the buyer of the assets, as Colorado Concrete Creations, LLC.
And why does it use buyer in paragraph 14?
Because that was a mistake by the attorney who drafted it.
Well, you said it was clear, and now you say it's a mistake. I don't think it's clear.
What's clear is, and this is my point on it, that paragraph relates only to somebody who's not a party to this contract. That'd be Wayne Hutchison. What that provision provides for is, if you're going to sell these personal items of personal property.
Let me stop you a minute, because what's not clear is the term buyer.
Well,
because it says Kent Murray will purchase real property.
Right. And this
and
is
the buyer who is purchasing real property is in paragraph 14. And you're saying that's different than the LLC.
That's correct. It's delineated in the asset purchase agreement itself. Your Honor, the asset purchase agreement deals only with the purchase of the business assets. It is only a contract with Steve Hutchison. The sale of the real property is with Wayne Hutchison. Totally separate deal.
Well, then, if you could address the promissory note, how does Kent Murray's signature on that note refute personal liability?
Well, because of several things. First, I think that you have to read that promissory note in conjunction with the asset purchase agreement, because again, that's the only contract that relates to the sale of these assets. It has to be read together. As the judge determined, it was ambiguous because the way the signature was done. And so if it's ambiguous...
Isn't that fairly clear?
Isn't it fairly clear what, Your Honor?
Well, he's signing not in such a way that is disclaiming personal liability.
I disagree, Your Honor, and here's
okay.
why.
That's what I'd like you to address, because I think that goes right to the heart of the whole...
All right, the heart of the whole thing is this. Mr. Murray, after this asset purchase agreement was there, and if you take a look at that again, it is clearly a contract only with the LLC. Mr. Murray goes out and buys a form promissory note. He matches that form promissory note and references an attachment to the asset purchase agreement in the promissory note, which is this Exhibit A, which identifies the assets and says that it's the promissory note is secured by that. When he brings the promissory note in, and I think this is key, he did this on his own, but he prints in before he walks into the closing on this deal, the name of the LLC, he prints it in a different color ink, and then signs below.
That's handwritten on there.
It's hand printed on there, but it's not handwritten. And my argument is, Your Honor, and I have not seen a case that says that that is not adequate, that that is not a clear representation of a signature on behalf of an LLC. And the reason I think it is because if you look at it in isolation, it is. But I think then if you look at the Uniform Commercial Code under 43117, then you can also read it in connection with that. And that says, along with Colorado case law, when you have an instrument that refers to another contract, that essentially the two things are construed together. And you read that instrument in connection with the other contract. If you read the promissory note in connection to that contract, it is clear that Murray is not purchasing the assets of the company. The purchaser of the assets of the company is the LLC that had been created. The only security given is the assets that are being purchased. And there's a UCC-1 statement filed that also references the only debtor as being the company. And that was by design. That's the way DeCarlo had done this. And the thing is, I think that signature can be deemed to be clear. But even, and I think it can be deemed to be clear because I don't think you even have to reach an ambiguity before you construe it in connection with the other document. But if you do construe it in connection with the other document, then it's even clearer. That document has to be read together with the promissory note. That document is only for the sale of assets, and therefore it's something that needs to be construed together. I cite for that, I cited that Bank of Kimball case where talks about construing the documents together. And I cited another case from Illinois, I think, which is a better description of that. I think I want to reserve some time on rebuttal. And I just want to mention now, too, with respect to the issues, this case was never really prosecuted against the LLC. It was always a case against Mr. Murray. Therefore, I think there's a claim also to be made that the LLC, the claims against the LLC were should have been dismissed, and no judgment should have been entered on that point either. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ed Ferry. I think that the most important thing to know about this case, and I think the court does know it, is that the document that was produced is a negotiable instrument. By its very terms, a negotiable instrument can be sold. You can have bona fide purchasers for value. You can have holders in due course. In this case, we know that it wasn't sold and that the original parties to the instrument are the parties in dispute today. But the note could have been sold to anyone. The note could have been sold to a bank. And if the bank were to, if there's a default on the note and the note is not paid, the bank would look to Mr. Murray to pay it because his signature is not unambiguous. It's as simple as that. If you sign a note, if you're the maker of a note and your signature appears on the note, the first rule of negotiable instruments is that you're liable on the note. So what Mr. Murray has to do is he has to find a way to avoid the liability that the first rule establishes. One of the ways you can avoid liability is if your signature is unambiguous in the fact that you are signing as a representative. And there, and then you're given an example of that. P by A, treasurer, principal by the agent who is the treasurer. He did not sign it that way. He signed it exactly the way that appears in case number 3 to comment number 2, the second comment. That's how he signed the document. He simply has Concrete Solutions, and then he has his name signed. Therefore, he does not escape liability from the first rule of negotiable instruments. And that's really the end of the case if the entity or the person suing was a holder in due course. If it was a holder in due course, we wouldn't be here today. A holder in due course would be able to sue Mr. Murray. Then the rule allows for equitable considerations to come into play when it's the original parties to the note. Here we have the original parties to the note, and the Uniform Commercial Code says that if, notwithstanding your signature, that is not unambiguous, notwithstanding that not unambiguous signature, if it was the intent of the parties that you only are signing in a representative capacity, well, then you can have a trial on that. And that's simply a trial of the facts. Did he or did he not sign? Was it or was it not the intent of the parties? Not the intent of Mr. Murray to trick my client, but was it the intent of the parties that the signature was to be in a representative capacity alone? And that's what the facts are in this case. That's what the case was about. Two cases were cited to this court by the appellant in his brief. Neither of those cases helped the appellant because those cases, in each of those cases, it was not an unambiguous signature. And therefore, the court in 1915 and the court in the Supreme Court in 1915 and the Supreme Court in 1957 found that what the intent was. And in each of those cases, it happened to be that the intent of the parties was a signature in a representative capacity. But this court at trial found that it was not the intent of the parties that he sign in a representative capacity. And there's many indicators of that fact. this court has to find that that factual determination by the court in considering the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses is clearly erroneous, and that simply aren't the facts. The facts are as follows. For example, my client was never advised by Murray that Murray was establishing this entity which came into existence 3 days before the document was signed. My client was dealing with a human being. He looked to the human being to pay him the money, not to some entity that never existed during the negotiations, not to some entity that has no history in business. He looked to the person to pay him, and that's who signed the note, the person. And that's what the court found, by the way. The court found that is true. The second thing the court found is that notwithstanding the defendant's attempt to have the court take a look at the agreement that was signed originally between the parties, there's obviously a difference in the way the signatures were signed. So that, the court said, showed that Mr. Murray knows how to sign in a representative capacity. He signed the purchase agreement in a representative capacity. Concrete Solutions by Kent Murray, manager. In distinction to that, he did not sign the promissory note that way. So he had the knowledge of how to do it, and he didn't do it. Then we have paragraph 14 in the contract, and 14 was a bargain for promise that my client insisted be in the contract, and that bargain for promise was that when you sell the real estate, you must pay off the promissory note. Well, the only person that could keep that promise was an individual human being, Kent Murray, in his individual capacity. And that's what the court found. The court found all of these things, and none of those findings by the court are not supported by the evidence. None of those findings by the court are clearly erroneous. So the defendant now puts his sights on 43117, other agreements affecting an instrument. That statute doesn't apply in this case. That statute applies if and only if that other agreement modifies, supplements, or nullifies the note that's being sued on, and this purchase agreement does none of those things. So the defendant's attempt to use this contract to show the intent of the parties backfires on them, because it clearly shows that wasn't the intent of the parties, that my client was going to look to some entity that exists only for 3 days to pay. So I think that the court should affirm the district court's, the district court clearly applied the correct law, the Uniform Commercial Code, section 3401 and section 3402, clearly applied the correct official comment to the 3402. The defendant complains, well, there's no case law on this that says that the signature should be in the form of principal by agent treasurer. And we suggest to this court that the reason that there's no case law on that is because the Uniform Commercial Code is crystal clear on how to do it correctly. And I cited Amjur from 1963, before the Uniform Commercial Code came into existence in Colorado. It's always been the rule that if you want to sign in a representative capacity, there's a way to do it that's recognized by the holder in due course. So the holder in due course knows who to go after. But then we have this fraud claim that was interposed by the defendant, both as a counterclaim and as a defense against the note. And once again, the court finessed a finding of who was right or who was wrong. The court didn't make a finding. My client denied making any of these representations, and the plaintiff insisted that the representations were made. But the court finessed that and found that even if the representations were made, no person could reasonably rely on the representations. And in fact, the reason why I would suggest to the court, and why the court below is correct, is that the representations are absurd. The representations, after all, are that this company makes $60,000 a year, but oh, by the way,
don't look at the books, because the books won't show that it makes $60,000 a year. So which is it that you're supposed to rely on? You can't rely on that.
Then we have the fact that Mr. Murray was present on site for three different times. He had the opportunity to do anything he wanted. One day he was there all day for 8 hours. He could have done anything. There was a month between the time that the contract was signed and that the contract closed by the execution of the promissory note, and Mr. Murray did practically nothing. In fact, not practically nothing, he did nothing. He
provision in the contract, Mr. Ferry, about his right to inspect, his right to look at anything about the business?
Yes, in the following sense. If you look at the contract, he had the sole ability, solely at his discretion, to say that I do not believe that what I'm buying is worth $75,000. So my client could not contradict that. All he had to do was say it, and the contract provides that in his sole discretion, he could do that.
So it's sort of like an inspection clause in a standard real estate contract?
It is. It is sort of like that. And we know that he did inspect. We know that he was there. We know that he testified and said, you know, this is a pretty rundown place. After all, the business that he's buying is making bird baths and fountains and stoppers for cars and parking lots and those sorts of things. It looked run down. Frankly, at trial, our side believed that he never intended to run that business anyway. What he intended to do was to purchase that business for the land. That's what he wanted. He wanted the land, and he wanted to put a bicycle shop on the land because it's in a prime spot in Colorado Springs, Colorado, on Colorado Avenue. I think that that's what the evidence has suggested in this case, but it's not part of the defense of the case. It's not a material fact one way or the other. What was in his mind, because we're dealing with a promissory note and the way he signed the promissory note on the one hand, and on the other hand, what he actually did to inspect it. And so for those reasons, I would ask the court to affirm the lower court. I do not think that this court can reasonably criticize the work of the lower court and say that the lower court's findings of fact were clearly erroneous. All of its findings of facts are supported by evidence. All of its findings of fact require the court to choose who to believe, and the court chose to believe the plaintiff's side of things and not the defense's side of things. And that is not something that an appellate court can or should criticize as being clearly erroneous. And then of course, on the note itself, I think that the court got it spot on. I mean, I don't know whether we should take what the appellant has said today as criticism of the court or not. Below, I wouldn't take it as a criticism. The court sat and heard the evidence, and I think, I'm not even sure the court went on for a five-minute recess, but the court was able to articulate the facts, was able to articulate the law, issued its judgment, and I think that rather than criticizing the court for only hearing it in one day and perhaps being rushed, that the contrary is true. The principles of law are so crystal clear in this case that the court was easily able to apply the facts to the law and came to a judgment that is consistent both with the facts and the law, and therefore I'd ask this court to affirm the judgment and holding of the court below. To the extent I'm required to ask for it, the promissory note does have a fee-shifting provision in it, and I think that we're entitled to our fees, too, to defend the judgment on appeal. Thank you very much.
With respect to the fraud issue, in the court's finding that there was no fraud because there's lack of detrimental reliance, I'm just briefly, the court needs to focus on the fact of the representation made regarding the $60,000, because there was no way to verify that because the seller of the property hid that again by saying it's not going to be reflected on the tax returns. That's all I mention on that, because I want to go back to what I think is the critical issue on this case. And I wholeheartedly disagree with Mr. Ferry. This is not a case about determining credibility of parties. This is a case about applying statutes to the documents that are in front of you. This whole business of talking about whether the signature would apply to a holder in due course or not is of no relevance here. What we're talking about, two parties to the situation. What we're, the issue really is on those examples that are cited in 43402, all those pertain to individuals where the parties have agreed that the principal individual is also liable for whatever the debt is. And then the issue becomes is whether the agent who signed in his capacity did it in a way that was clear enough to make sure that the agent wasn't also responsible. Now, that's fine when you're dealing with individuals, but when you're dealing with an entity such as a limited liability company, the only way it can sign is through an individual. The only signature that appeared on here was the signature of Kent Murray. The entity's name appeared in print on a different document, in different writing that was brought into this deal. I would submit to you that there's no case that says that that's not unambiguous, that's not clear enough. There are cases that say you don't need to put the word by in there. That's what SHOOK stands for. And so if we're talking about, well, Murray screwed this whole thing up because you didn't put comma member, then that would have to be the ruling on that. But then you have to go back to that document. And what the trial court made the error on is he didn't construe the two documents together, and you have to. That's what 43117 says. That's what the Bank of Kimball case says. You construe them together. If you have ambiguity in the promissory note in terms of the signature, then you go back and you look at the entire transaction. And what happened here was exactly what Mr. DeCaro tried to do with this. Murray had put down $22,500 on this deal for the purchase of these assets, 30% of the entire purchase price. And what DeCaro wanted to make sure happened was that he's not personally liable for anything else in this, because DeCaro, he testified on this, it's in the record, he didn't know what the condition of the business was, what the conditions of the assets was. So that was the intent, make Murray not personally liable, and Hutchinson's covered because he's got 20% or 30% down on the deal, $22,500, and Murray made payment for years and drew down the principal balance of $9,000. But that's what the whole intent was here. Hutchinson has been he was a president of credit union at the time. He knew darn well what these contracts were all about. He knew what guarantees were all about. He'd read and reviewed contracts. He had this contract for a month before the deal ever closed. And the issue here is not looking at Mr. Murray or judging Mr. Murray's credibility or his testimony or Mr. Hutchinson for that matter. It's applying what the law is. And the law says that when this judge, if he determined that that signature was ambiguous, he had to look back at the entire transaction. And when you look back at the entire transaction, that contract is only between the Colorado Concrete Creations and Mr. Hutchinson. Mr. Murray is not personally involved in that contract. That other provision was put in for his brother, so that in the event that these assets sold, that Murray would have to pay his brother back first. His brother isn't here. There were no generated proceeds from this sale to speak of. But that's the point. This is just not a question of fact case. This is just a situation where the judge looked at this. If you go down through the comments on 43402, he read that, and he talked about the parole evidence rule. And when you get down there, it refers you specifically to 3117. He never asked me a single question about that part of it on closing statement. But then he didn't apply that provision, and that provision has to be applied. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.